How do you know that Nehemiah is the author of the book of Nehemiah? If someone were to ask you, is it because Nehemiah occurs as the title in your Bible? Chapter 1, verse 1. He said the words of Nehemiah, and then he says, while I was in Susa the capital, you see the first person, we see that throughout the book. And so you're not dependent upon what the translators have put at the top of the book. You know that he is the author of the book. Okay, now, about what time period do the events that we're reading about occur?
Four forty-five,
and go for a span of about how many years?
415.
Okay, that wouldn't be far off. 450. We have 445, and he specifically mentions another date, a number of years. Mentions 12 years, doesn't he? And then he says, after some time. So we're down to 433 plus whatever after some time is. And so in the getting down nearly to the end of the 400s, but somewhere in the lower half of the 400s is when these events occur. And where was Nehemiah when this account begins? Where?
Babylon.
And so, wasn't he a Hebrew? Is that right? Was he over in Babylon on vacation or something? Is that why he ended up over there? He went over there on a trip, said, I really like it over here, so I'll just live here.
Captivity.
So, when he comes back, it's generally called a return, right? That was his homeland. That is, of his fathers. And so we have three times that happened after the captivity. The first time some Hebrews made a return to their homeland was when? 536, for the express purpose of building the temple. And then another group made a return. When was that? 458. What was the express purpose of that? Who led that one?
Ezra.
What did he go back for? To teach the law. To teach the law there in his home country. And he accomplished some reforms. And then we have this third return led by Nehemiah. Okay, so that's the three returns. That kind of gives a bird's eye setting of where we're at as we study the book. All right, so we began here in chapter 1 with him finding out of the condition of the walls, his inquiry from those who came to Babylon. We saw in chapter 1 he went to God in prayer about that God might give him favor before the king. Chapter 2. First part of the chapter, he actually goes to the king. He's bearing the cup for the king and asks the king's favor to be able to return and rebuild the city. And the king grants him that favor. So he returns to Jerusalem. At the end of chapter 2, he does a survey of the walls, finds them broken down and burned with fire, gets an assessment of the situation, but makes a determination that he's going to rebuild the walls and has the support of some of the people that are there. And so then in chapter 3, we have the progress of the work, kind of a summary of the progress of the work. In fact, when you look at chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, Eliashib the high priest arose with his brothers the priests and built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and hung its doors. And so you go through it, and we gave you a map of the city walls. You can see all the gates around the city. That city was surrounded by walls. That's the way they protected their cities. And so they restored all those gates. But actually, when you look at chapter 7, verse 1, after the wall was complete, chapter 6:15 said, when the wall was rebuilt and I had set up the doors. It may be, I'm not certain about this, that in chapter 3 it's just a summary, but they didn't set the doors in place then. It wasn't until the wall was finished that finally the doors were set in place. Yes? Do what? Do I have another map? I do have another map. Anybody else that did not get one, want one? All you've got to do, if you get a map, you've got to memorize all the gates in order. If I didn't get somebody, they'll be up here, so or up on the front pew. Feel free to pick up a copy. They're also on the website, so you can download one off the website if you wish. Okay, and so we have what was particularly interesting that we observed in class about the rebuilding of the walls. All kind of different people. You read in the first verse, maybe the last guy you'd think that would be involved in going out and fooling with rubble and stones and that kind of thing, the high priest. But you also read about, you get down to verse 8, you read about goldsmiths and perfumers. You read about verse 12, officials and even their daughters being involved in this. And then verse 17, the Levites. And verse 26, the temple servants. And then verse 29, the keeper of the gate. And so it's just, and then in verse 32, the merchants. And so you have people of all ranks of society to cooperate. And when you think about that, when you get people working together, we'll see a statement that the people had a mind to work. We'll observe that. When you get people of all different ranks willing to work together and forget about their pride and selfishness, what can be accomplished? How long have these walls been in disrepair? Okay, more than that, that's right. And you're dating from another date. When were they destroyed? 586. We're in 445, so 140 years. And how long had it been since the first return? About 90 years. And somebody, I think somebody said 70 year, which is a good date because the temple was finished in 516. And so even though the temple had been finished, these walls lay in ruins. How long did it take him to finish them? Chapter 6, verse 15? 52 days. Less than 2 months. Isn't that amazing? Because people work together. People of all ranks work together. Teamwork. Joining in together. What a lesson for us in a local church. What can we do if everybody pitches in and works together? That's what you have here in chapter 3. Okay, we're in chapter 4 tonight. We suggested, first of all, at the very beginning in our first lesson, we did a synopsis of each chapter. And then we come back on each chapter to review that. What was your synopsis about what's in chapter 4? Opposition. Jackson had an answer, but it was wrong. But it's opposition. All right, good. Okay, and so you see the opposition that they faced, and we're going to be looking at that. And we'll see two kinds of opposition in this chapter. So let's begin to read here. Now it came about that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. Sanballat was likely a Samaritan, right? And the Samaritans had a great enmity toward the Jews. And that enmity had certainly been incensed in a previous incident. What was it? They wouldn't let them help rebuild the temple. That's right. The time, not Ezra wasn't there, but in the time of Zerubbabel. They're in the first part of the book of Ezra. And so now here they come, and he's very furious. He spoke in the presence of his brothers and of the wealthy men of Samaria. You can see he's a man of Samaria, with influence in Samaria, and said, "What are these feeble but Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish in a day? Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones?" What proves that these questions are not genuine? I mean, if he really believed that they could not do that, would it have bothered him? You see, he is concerned about them doing that. And this is just mockery. That's our first answer. What was he appealing to in verse 2 and 3? You see, now Tobiah the Ammonite joins in on this. He was near him. He said, "Even what they're building, a fox should jump on, he would break their stone wall down." Mockery. And mockery out of fear, they're going to do it. And so they try to intimidate them with that mockery. Verse 4 here, "O our God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads and give them up for plunder in a land of captivity." I thought we were supposed to pray for mercy for people. Is he praying for God to be merciful? No. What kind of prayers that you find all through the book of Psalms where instead of praying for mercy, people pray for judgment? Imprecatory prayers. That's right. It's what they're called. People have the idea that Christians are people that just forgive anybody. They come and shoot your family and burn down your house and you say, "I forgive you." That's a bunch of baloney. People didn't get that out of the Bible. And you see Nehemiah, a godly man, praying for divine justice. Not that he's going to do it, but for God to render justice to his enemies. And godly men prayed that way. It's God's business, not Nehemiah's. But you see Nehemiah praying that kind of prayer. What does he say in that next verse? Is that rather shocking? Do not forgive them. What? Is this a godly man? Is he? Yes. Yes. God told Jeremiah one time, don't even pray for the people. People can be so hardened in their sin, so obstinate against God's will, there's no forgiveness. And there's no use asking for it. God's not going to give it. And that's not a spirit of hatred of your neighbor. It's the idea that there's something in us that cries out for divine vengeance, to be avenged. You'll see that in the book of Revelation when we study it. But the souls under the altar crying that God would avenge their blood. God will avenge the righteous. Don't think that he won't. But it's an interesting lesson about Nehemiah and men of godliness that they're not just bunch of folks like milquetoast that have no courage, no conviction. You do anything you want to me, it's okay. I'll just forgive you. Well, the Bible doesn't teach that. So, in spite of how bad they treat you, though, if they're penitent, should you forgive them? What's the supreme example of that? Jesus Christ on the cross. Father, forgive them, for they know not what to do. So God then all of a sudden just forgave the entire Jewish nation, right? No, it's conditional. Jewish nation was judged, brought to an end. But those who would repent, even those who had a part in having Jesus crucified, could be forgiven. And Peter preached to some of those very people on the day of Pentecost. But he told them they had to repent. And so, some good lessons here about the proper attitude that godly people have. Do not forgive their iniquity, and let not their sin be blotted out before you, for they have demoralized the builders. You know, we are responsible for the effect, for the impact of our conduct. Do you remember an incident in Israelite history where God became very angry with people because they discouraged others from doing what they needed to do? What?
The spies.
The spies, that's right. And the 10 spies discouraged the people. And God became so angry, he said, I'm going to destroy all the soldiers, except for two. And then when they got to the border of the promised land 38 years later, Reuben and Gad, Moses thought was not going to go fight. He brought that back up again. He said, God was angry when this happened before. And if you discourage people, God's going to be angry with you. And so we can demoralize. We could take away other people's desire to work and build and do God's will and then stand back and maybe just think, we didn't do anything. Yes, you did. And the mockery of God's people when they're trying to do what's right, and that's what's going on here. And we'll see that oftentimes from our enemies, mocking God's people, trying to demoralize you. Satan knows it works. And that's why he uses it. But fortunately, they had a strong leader here, a man of faith. He would not bend to it. And so, they used mockery. Now, we ask another question here. What other did they use besides mockery? What are we getting ready to read about in verse 7 following? Well, they used ridicule and mockery in that first part, but what are they going to do now? Verse 8.
Conspiracy.
The conspiracy. They're going to get together and say, we're going to get together and stop this. Conspiracy. Jesus faced conspiracy, didn't he? Sure. Did Paul face conspiracy? Yes. It's always been an enemy, God's people, that the enemies will, they'll forget their differences to conspire together against God's people. And it'll happen today in religion. And so don't be alarmed by that. It's always been the case. The question is, are we going to let that undermine what we need to do? That those who are against God's ways will conspire against us. Now when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the repair of the walls in Jerusalem went on, so the mockery didn't work, and that the breaches began to be closed, they were very angry. All of them conspired together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause a disturbance in it. But we prayed to our God, and because of them, we set up a guard against them day and night. You find Nehemiah doing a lot of praying, don't you? He was a very strong leader, but he's also a man devoted to prayer. You see that in David. David was a general, a leader of an army, but he did a lot of praying. If you want to read his prayers, read the book of Psalms. And so you see Nehemiah given to prayer. It's alarming that sometimes God's people don't pray. No wonder they lose the battle against sin. And so, it says, we prayed to our God. Because of them, we set up a guard against them day and night. So praying by itself wouldn't do the trick. You pray to God, you ask His blessing, but you got to get up and do something. That's interesting, isn't it? He didn't just pray to God and say, here, God, you zap them. They set up a guard. And they asked God's blessing in what they were doing. Thus in Judah it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing, yet there's much rubbish. And we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. Our enemies said, They will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to the work. When the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, is that 10 one more than 9 or one less than 11?
Complete.
The word 10 is used in the Bible not to designate numerically the number 10, but a concept, an idea. They told us and told us and told us, look, they're going to come up against from every place where you may turn. And so I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall. And that's our next question here. I got it, number 4. What defense measures were taken? So we're reading about that starting here in verse 13, some of the defense measures that were taken. I don't know how you worded your answer to that, but here's one of the things right here. He said, I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, the exposed place. Remember, the wall's all broken down. Usually that's their defense. Okay, I'm going to put people here where the wall's gone. Protect those places. Station the people in families with their swords, spears, and bows. What do you reckon when these guys went home at night after building on the walls and talked to their families and knew their lives were in danger? You think there was ever any fear, any conversation at the supper table about, well, sweetheart, I don't know if you ought to be involved in this. You may get killed. Yes, sir.
I think also along with this, the parts of the wall that were built, the houses were there. So the people protecting the wall hadn't had it, I guess you could say, desire to protect their portion of the wall.
Because yeah.
Their family was right there. So if the enemy penetrated there, the first place to go was...
Good point. And we'll see that they actually worked and defended that part of the wall where their place was. It's a good point. Yeah, and I guess they'd think, you know, I'd be the first one that attack. Good point. And so these people are not just soldiers, but it's the common people, evidently, of all sorts that now take up weapons, swords, spears, and bows. And so when I saw their fear, I arose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome. And fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. You've probably heard sermons, if you've been a Christian very long, along the line of something called the language of victory. And based on the book of Nehemiah. We've got a number of verses here. Throughout the book of Nehemiah, and my question probably wasn't too good. I said Nehemiah said things. Not all these verses are what he said. And so that was kind of misleading. I'm sorry about that. But there are phrases throughout the book that reflect attitudes and words that will equip people to have victory in the face of trial and difficulty. Let's start back in chapter 2 and verse 18. What do we have here? The what now? Okay, God had been favorable, and that is a good point. What did Nehemiah say? And that's right, that was certainly an encouragement to him. What did Nehemiah say to the people when these enemies threatened them? Verse 18. Let us arise and build. There's a spirit, yes. Well, I know it's people, but you got that. The people said that first, and then... down in Nehemiah said, let us rebuild the wall in 17 and also in 20. We as servants will arise and build. So you're right. It's actually the people in 18. But you're supposed to read that question and decipher what's meant, see? I said I didn't word the question good. But that is, whether it's Nehemiah's mouth or whether the people's mouth, it's that attitude. All right, there's some work to be done here. What are we going to do about it? It's a difficult work. Hadn't been tackled now since the temple was finished 70 years ago. Now we've got opposition on top of that. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to get up and get busy. Let us arise and build. Would to God we'd have those kind of attitudes. All right? And so, in verse 20, kind of refers to what Ennis was talking about. They said, the God of heaven will give us success. In verse 18, the way it's put is, the hand of my God has been favorable to him. He had already been favorable to him in giving him journey to there, giving him letters to the governors of the provinces. And now he's saying, looking into the future now, God will give us success. Here's what's happened. The hand of God has been favorable. But look at this spirit of faith. God will help us accomplish this. And so you see that spirit of faith. And how would God help them? What were they going to face? I don't know that he knew all of that. He just believed that if he was doing what God wanted him to do, that God would bless him. That's what faith is. It's not a blind faith. It's a confidence in the grace, mercy, and power of God, which he expressed in his prayer in chapter 1. All right, chapter 4, verse 6. Again, I admit it's not what Nehemiah said, but it's a statement about that Nehemiah did write down that it gives you a clue as to why they were successful. What is that phrase? The people had a mind to work. You know, one of the problems sometimes in local churches is people treat it like a theater. You go to the movie show, you sit on the pew and watch what goes on. You're an observer. We're not observers, we're workers. We're all in this thing together. You know, we've got a gospel meeting coming up this weekend. Is it, oh, that's their gospel meeting. Is that, oh, that's the church's gospel meeting, meaning somebody out there. Or is that our gospel meeting? Which is that? It says the people had a mind to work. Set your minds on it. Instead of making excuses and waiting for George to do it. And it's interesting that Nehemiah wrote that. Nehemiah is his assessment of a contributing factor in getting this wall built. In chapter 4 and verse 14, at least my question fits this time. What did he say this time? Do not be afraid of them. And why shouldn't you be afraid, did he say? All right, remember the Lord who's great and awesome. Remember the Lord. Don't forget the Lord. You know, we talk about the Lord. He's out there somewhere. Is he involved in our lives? Is he involved in getting the work done that he wants to get done? Remember the Lord who's great and awesome. That's what he prayed about in his prayer. He says, here's what you did. You said if the people didn't follow you, you'd scatter them. You did that. You said if they'd return to you, you'd bring them back. You did that. And then he asked for compassion from the king, and he got it. And so he said, this great God, he's great, he's awesome, don't forget him. He's more powerful than Sanballat and Tobiah and the Ammonites and all these people who are against you. And that's the language of victory and faith. In chapter 4 and verse 20, what did he say? Our God will fight for us. And then in chapter 6, and you didn't find it in verse 9, did you? In verse 16, what did he say? That's part of the built-in things about my lesson. See, I build in the clues, you see, that you say, well, that's not in that verse. I got to go find that somewhere. That's much better saying that than just say I made a mistake. But anyway, verse 16, our God, look at verse 16, with the help of our God. With the help of our God. And so all through the book, you see this kind of, not either Nehemiah saying it or he's recording it as he looks back on this great accomplishment and points out for the reader the things that helped these people accomplish something so remarkable in such a short time. And so we're seeing the measures they took. We continue that. We had question number 4 here. We just got started on that. And so verse 15, when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, Then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. And it says God frustrated their plan. Did God come down and zap them with a disease or what? Did God give them mental dementia or what? God frustrated their plan.
God was actively helping them complete the wall.
That's right. God was working through his people, and that frustrated their plan. See, God frustrated their plan, but he did it through his people, through their attitude and their work. And God can accomplish things through you and me. And so God frustrated their plan. Then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. From that day on, half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, and the breastplates. And the captains were behind the whole house of Judah. Those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand doing the work and the other holding a weapon. As for the builders, each one wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpeters stood near me. So just think, now here you got some of them that are ready with weapons, some of them are working, some who are carrying burdens or carrying the burden with one hand holding a weapon with the other. Those who are actually working on the wall, they're wearing something girded about them with a sword on them. And so they're working, but they're also ready to fight. They're prepared. And they've got this trumpeter. And so I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we're separated on the wall far from one another. Whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Another good lesson about building. Rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. Here's the alarm. Here's the danger right now. Let's all get together and fight here. Stop this danger. And as you look back over religious history, you see that happening. Back in the 40s, there was the threat of the sponsoring church, that kind of thing, and preachers arose, and brethren arose, and fought that. And down through the years, there's been other issues like that have arisen. And brethren need to band together and rally together in the fight for God's work. Verse 21, so we carried on the work with half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared. At that time I also said to the people, let each man with his servant spend the night within Jerusalem, so that there may be a guard for us by night and a laborer by day. So neither I, my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us removed our clothes. Each took his weapon, even to the water. You mean Nehemiah too? Sound like Nehemiah too. Boy, just here, you go do that. I've got to go back to the governor's palace here. I'm right out there working with you. And some of the great military leaders, that was one characteristic of them. They were leading their troops. And that's what you see here in Nehemiah's case. Any other comments on chapter 4? Yes, sir.
I was thinking about what you were saying earlier about how did God go about doing these things and telling the people. And I'm thinking, well, in the past, many times God worked in, and when the people went to battle, he was helping them to be successful in the battle. So these times that they were attacked by the wall and the people were resisting, then he was probably helping them.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but that, you're right in the fact that it clearly indicates in the text that our God has frustrated their plan is through the courage and the faith and the determination of these people. That much I do know from the text. Now, whether God additionally assisted them in fighting, I don't know that. And as Ennis pointed out, it's a good point. But I do know he's involved in frustrating the plan because these people had a mind to work. God could have wiped out all the enemies, but he used his people. He wanted them to have the faith and courage to do the work, and then he assisted them in that.
The reason I'm saying that is because these people were not warriors until they were not accustomed to using swords.
Okay.
Seems like
it. Yeah, and I don't know if they ever really had to actually engage in battle. There's nothing about it. It may be the enemy said, you know, this ain't turning out like it's supposed to. I think we'll just forget about this. We might get hurt. Yes, sir.
I remember you mentioned something about them working together, and I was thinking about the idea that when you're working, you know, that prevents a lot of problems. You know, when you're busy, you don't have time to bicker with your neighbor or fight or fuss or gossip or all these other things that cause problems. And what we're going to see in the next chapter is there's a group of people who weren't working, and they seem to be the ones that are causing the problem in chapter 5.
Yeah, if we stay busy, that helps relieve a lot of problems, and that's certainly true. And that's certainly a good observation. All right, let's look at chapter 5. Now, what's chapter 5 about when you did your synopsis? What is it about? What?
Internal oppression.
So you got all these people outside that Nehemiah's got to deal with. But that's not all. You know, if you're in Nehemiah's shoes, how long has Nehemiah been here now? How long was the wall, how long did it take to finish the wall? 615. We talked about that already. Less than 2 months. He got all this other stuff, and now he's got his own people with problems. What would you do as a leader? Would you say, that's enough, I've had it, enough of this. But men like Moses, special man. I just stand amazed at a man like Moses. Nehemiah, great men, great leaders. They wouldn't let these things discourage them. And there's men today who, like elders, for example, there's men who have the good character qualifications. They'll never be qualified to serve as leaders because when the dangers come and the difficulties come, they're ready to throw in the towel or go call the preacher. And you can't be a leader if you don't have the courage to do what Paul talked about to those elders in Ephesus, and that's confront people about their lives and face difficulties and false teachers or whatever it may be. And you see this in these men like Nehemiah. All right, so here now we're going to find he's got to face difficulty even among his own people, and he's got to have to deal with it. So let's start here and look at least at the first three verses. Now, there was a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers. You know, it's bad enough when you got external opposition, but boy, internal opposition can destroy a nation, a church, a family. And so there were those who said, we, our sons and our daughters are many. Therefore, let us get grain that we may eat and live. We ask you the question on your sheet. The famine caused two problems. What are they? What's the problem in verse 2? Well, let me read verse 3. There were others who said, we're mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses that we may get grain because of the famine. So what's the problem? Yeah, they're hungry. We need food. That's pretty basic, isn't it? We got to eat. We don't have any grain. Verse 2 may have been people who didn't have property. Verse 3, people who had property. So we got to mortgage our property, try to get grain. We just can't. And there's a famine. Now, remember, Nehemiah's been here less than 2 months. And so this famine may have predated Nehemiah. And oftentimes God would use famines in the land to judge his people. Of course, they've been sitting around doing nothing about this wall. Right? And so now, if that is a judgment from God, I don't know if it was or not. But if it was, they're suffering the consequences of their own lack of activity. I know in the book of Malachi, God told them that your problem with your crops is because of the way you're trying to worship me. We see that all through the book of Amos. I do know God used those judgments with his nation. Whether or not that's what happened here, I don't know. So anyway, because of the famine, they're really having trouble having enough to eat. And then verse 4, there were those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. So what's the second problem?
They're not going to pay tax on property that they've already mortgaged.
Yeah, we can't pay our taxes. We're having to mortgage our field. We can't pay our taxes. You are still under the Persian dominion. And the Persian king expected tribute. We can't pay our tax. We can't feed our families. We can't pay our taxes. Is that going to distract them from this work they're engaged in? Oh, yes. You know, the devil doesn't give up. When you see the book of Acts, and you see these apostles going out preaching this gospel, and people by the thousands are obeying it, he starts trying one thing and then another. He tried fear. He tried threats. He had them in prison. He tried beating them. That didn't stop them. So he said, okay, I'll try diversion. Chapter 6 said, maybe I can get these elders worried about serving tables, taking care of the needy instead of preaching the word. I'll try that. That didn't work either. Get to chapter 19, he said, I know what I'll do. I'll try counterfeit. Tried these guys, you know, to cast out demons in the name of Jesus. That didn't work either. He didn't give up. And so if one thing don't work, he tried mockery, tried conspiracy. That didn't work. Maybe he can use the people themselves against themselves. And you see him at work here behind the scenes and all of this. Okay. I guess this would be a good place to stop. We'll pick up with verse 4.